Peter Donat. In the previous program on transformations of myth through time, Joseph Campbell spoke of the birth of Western civilization in the Arthurian romances of the 12th century. These stories were to crystallize the conflict then existing between the individual and society, between man and God. Out of this conflict, a new idea emerged. The individual heart became the origin of the life-giving powers of myth. In this program, Joseph Campbell, the storyteller, draws us into the Arthurian world of courtly love, a realm where matters of the heart become issues of life and death. Campbell concludes with the story of Tristan and Isolde, two lovers in a world too small for the energy of their souls.
It's this idea of the individual and the individual quest that we're going to be talking about today. In the old cultures, the Oriental cultures, everyone is of a certain class, and each class has its own dharma, its own duty system, and the individual wears the mask of his caste, how he dresses and all that. There's very little of that. There has to be that, of course, in every life, but where is the accent? Is the accent on the individual who is playing a role, or is the accent on the role and the individual wiped out? And of course, the great symbolic moment in the Greeks' own understanding of this matter was the great battle of Marathon, where a couple of dozen Greeks knocked down an army of hundreds, thousands of slaves. The Persian slave civilization, you might say, trying to master the Greek world, met its term. They had conquered everything in Asia, from the Ionian Isles to the Indus River, including all the world of the ancients, Mesopotamia, Egypt, and all. And the Greeks stopped them. A few years later, Alexander the Great goes smashing through the whole Persian Empire, a young man in his early 20s. With the idea of a self-directed, not overmastered field of action. Well, this morning I presented something of the historical backgrounds, spoke of Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, where the story of Arthur as a king first appears. We now know from the chronicles he was not a king. He was a dux bellorum, a war leader, who assisted the British kings in defending the land against the incoming Anglo-Saxons and Jutes. He died, the land was conquered. At least what we call England was conquered. But the Celtic lands, the earlier Celtic peoples, were not. The Scots, the Welsh, the Cornish, and the Irish, and the people of the Isle of Man. Well, that's treasury hold, you might say, of the old Celtic traditions. It's out of those that this material comes, Brittany and so forth. Then we have the conquest of the English, who have conquered the Celts. The conquest of the English, in the only date most people know, 1066, by Norman the Conqueror, who brings the North French, really Norman people, into Britain. Now, you know how it is on a college campus. Here are the freshmen, and they've been persecuted by the sophomores. Here are the Celts, and they've been persecuted by the English. Next year, they all move up, you see? And in comes another freshman class. This earlier freshman class is now the sophomore class. They're persecuting. But that earlier sophomore class was formerly the freshman class persecuted by the sophomores who are now the juniors. So there's a kind of fellowship between the juniors and the freshmen against the sophomores. You have the Celts, you have the English, you have the Normans. The Normans and the Celts against the English. The English were put out into the pigsties. And nobody spoke English in England. They all spoke Norman French. And to this day, we have the Norman French words for the meat when it appeared on the table, and the English word for the meat when it was out in the farm. Swine out there, pork at the table. Calves out there, veal at the table. And these Normans, they didn't have TV in those days, so what do you do with your time? Well, they liked to hear stories. And the best stories in the world were the old Celtic tales. So this whole tradition of oral bardic literature, which had grown up, the hope of the Bretons and so forth, becomes told in the Norman courts by the bards. Meanwhile, there's this great, great dame of the whole Middle Ages, Eleanor of Aquitaine. She was the wife of two great kings. She was married to King Louis of France and went with him on the Crusades and came back completely bored with Louis. And so one morning he wakes up and Eleanor has gone. She's gone to England to marry the King of England, Henry II. So she's the wife of two kings. She's the mother of King John. She's the mother of Richard the Lionhearted. And she's the grandmother of every royal head in the land of Europe in the generation next. She's it. And her period is exactly the period of the Grail Romances. Now, where did she come from? Eleanor of Aquitaine. She came from the south of France. So she brings the south of France to the English throne and is the, you know, inheritor of the traditions of the whole of Europe. Her grandfather, William of Poitiers, was the first of the troubadours. Now, the Arthurian tradition through the bards goes to the continent. The continent isn't interested in Arthur, it's interested in his knights. The stories of these Celtic heroes transformed into Christian armor-clad knights. And meanwhile, the stories come into the field of courtly love. Eleanor and her daughter, Blanche of Castile, and there's another name just slipped me right this minute. They are the great ladies of the period. And they were the ones who were the cultivators of the whole theme of courtly love. And as I've said already, courtly love had to do with love and not with marriage. The whole tradition of the troubadours has to do with love. And our tradition of psychology begins at that time. What is the psychology of love? What happens when this thing strikes? There were debates among the troubadours as to what love was. And the formulation that, or one of the formulations that was most, apt, is that of the troubadour Girault de Bornay, G-I-R-H-A-U-L-T, D-E, B-O-R-N-E-I-L-H, Bornay. He wrote a poem in which he analyzed what love was. And he says, "The eyes are the scouts of the heart. The eyes go forth to find an image to recommend to the heart. And when the eyes have found such an image, if the heart and here's the key word, is a gentle heart. That means a heart capable not simply of lust, but of love, two totally different things. Then love is born. This is news. When you hear from pulpits talk about love, there are two kinds of love, and neither one is personal. The first kind of love is lust. Now, this I define as the zeal of the organs for each other. It has nothing to do with who's on top. It's completely impersonal. And the other definition of love is agape, spiritual love. Love thy neighbor as thyself, no matter who it is. Completely impersonal. Here comes Europe, the personal experience. The eyes go forth to find an image to recommend to this heart. And this is not a heart of lust, but a heart that knows how to respond to an image. This is what Freud calls voyeurism. That's the rescue, delight in the manifestation of the divine in a person. And then one is completely taken by this, and nothing else counts. Nothing else counts. And in the courtly tradition, nothing else counts. Amor, and what is the principal threat? Honor. So you find in these traditions of the Middle Ages this conflict between honor and love. The ultimate sacrifice for a noble heart is the sacrifice of honor for love. So that's the theme that we're up against here now. Well, there are a lot of wonderful stories about the troubadour. There's a whole volume of lives of the troubadours from the 12th century. The wild absurdities to win the woman's regard. There's one troubadour who fell in love with a woman whose name meant wolf. You know, so you'd fall in love with Miss Wolf. So he goes out and he gets himself a wolf skin. And he clothes himself in the wolf skin and then pretends as a wolf to attack a shepherd's flock of sheep. And of course, the sheep dogs pounce on him and tear him to pieces. And so he's in pretty bad shape. And he's taken into the woman's castle to be healed by her and her husband. Well, that's one. Then there's another who bought himself the robe of a leper and cut off two of his fingers and then sat among the lepers as beggars. And the lady comes out of her castle and says, "Why, my God, there's Girard." And so he won her regard that way. And wonderful stories of this. Then there were the courts of love, where the ladies sat in judgment on cases. For example, there's one very famous case of a gentleman who proposed himself to a lady and, as her lover, and she said no, she had a lover. But if she cast him off or lost that lover, this is next on line. And what happened was her husband died and she married her lover, and along comes Buddy and says, "Here I am." I says, "Why, no, I've married my lover." He said, "But, you know, there's no such thing as married love." So they brought it to the court. And according to the report, the court declares that married love is a contradiction in adjective. And he was next on line, that's all. So you have this tension in the medieval world between these two traditions. The principal language for the celebration of courtly love, or is Provençal, which is the language of France, the south of France, the Languedoc. And I can tell you, I spent a whole year working on Languedoc at the University of Paris. It's pretty boring stuff. What are you going to say? But the interest is formal. Then say how to get the lady's name into the poem without her husband recognizing it. So a lot of the intricacies of poetic, you might say, virtuosity have to do with this hidden address to the lady. Now there's an important thing about courtly love. The lady must assure herself that it is a gentle heart. That's to say that this is not just a lusty boy coming in. And so you have this whole tradition of delay and test and trial. If the chap is good with sword and lance, you send him out to guard a bridge. Traffic in the Middle Ages was considerably encumbered by young men guarding bridges. They wouldn't let anybody across. And this kind of thing, it didn't amount to anything except a test that the lady has put on you. Or if you were better with the pen than with the sword, poems, things like that. Then when the lady is assured that what is being addressed to her is the gentle and not the lusty heart, she may grant what is known as merci. That's a technical term. Now, merci and the degree of merci that's granted will depend on the lady's opinion of the lover. It may consist in a privilege of kissing her on the back of the neck once every Whitsuntide, or it may go considerably further than that. The lady who accepts service without, at some time, ultimately expressing either conviction and merci or rejection is sauvage. She is savage. And this turns up in the medieval stories of women who were sauvage. And the man trying to prove himself, exposes himself in jousting or in battle in a wild way and gets killed, and then she realizes and so forth and so on. So that's the background of what I'm going to talk about now. The appearance of Arthurian romances on the continent. We've spoken about it in England with the whole history of King Arthur. The appearance on the continent with the stories of the knights. The first writer was the court poet of Marie de Champagne, who was the daughter of Eleanor. This is the name I couldn't think of a couple of minutes ago. Her court poet was Chrétien of Troy, or Christian of Troy. Chrétien de Troyes. In Old French, you don't say what, you say oi, Troyes. Chrétien begins writing at the end of the 12th century. You can put sort of 1160 to 90 as the main dates there. It used to be thought, let's say the first years of this century by the scholars, that Chrétien was the one who invented these stories. We now know he did not. He was the one who first rendered them in writing from the storytellers, the Celtic bardic storytellers who were in the courts of the south and in the north. I will tell you the names of the writings of Chrétien. The first, and it's been lost, was his Tristan, Chrétien's Tristan, and the date would have been something like 1160 or something like that. His was the earliest Tristan, apparently, but then a whole spate of Tristans. A lot of great Tristans. And Thomas of Britain is a major figure, his Tristan. And then the one that Wagner used, is Gottfried of Strasbourg. And his date's about 1210. That's to say, half a century after Kratian. Well, the ladies of the court were not altogether pleased with the Tristan. What happened in Tristan was a young couple drank the potion and were just seized with love and then went out into the forest. So it was a wild love in the forest. No, love must be in the court. The second Kratian, you can see he was writing for Marie, was Erec, E-R-E-C. It's a wonderful story. It's the story of a young knight who had heroic fame and then falls in love. Oh, this is a modern as well as an ancient theme. His fame career is wrecked by his devotion to his love. This is the thing. Honor or love? His honor was wrecked. He was no longer winning, let's say, the battles. When he realizes this, he then becomes rejective of her. This is the normal thing for today, you know. You marry at 22, you divorce at 28, and recover. So he pushes her aside and then goes forth to win back his fame. She trots along behind him. Oh, she's right there all the time. And finally, her loyalty to him in her rejection solves the whole thing. Oh, that was a nice one. That's the Erec. The next is Kratian's Cliges, C-L-I-G-E-S, with an accent grave over the E. This is a strange story. There were a lot of stories coming in from the Orient at this time, and there's a lot of Oriental stuff in this Cliges. The story here. I've read scholars who say this is a moral story, whereas the others with adultery in it are immoral. This is a moral story. She will not grant merci to her lover because she's married and will not commit adultery. So they bring it about that her husband dies, and then she can have her lover. That's a moral story. And it's one that never got very far in the Middle Ages. Nobody picked that one up. Then comes the great story of Kratian, and this is the Lancelot. Here you have the Mordred story translated to Lancelot. Lancelot was Arthur's greatest knight, and he falls in love with Guinevere, and he goes through the whole ordeal. He becomes le fou, the one who's absolutely mad for love. The two of them completely engaged in a torrent of passion. Well, the great story is she's abducted. These women in the Middle Ages and also in the earlier Greek tradition have a habit of being abducted and then saved. Helen of Troy was abducted several times. The whole Trojan War was to get her back for Menelaus. And Helen kept being abducted, and this time she's abducted by the lord of a castle which is equated with the underworld. Arthur doesn't go to get her back. Lancelot goes. And he goes with such speed that he rides two horses to death. Well, after you've lost two horses and you don't have another, and here you are walking in a suit of armor, you're not getting very far, very fast. He's plowing along there. And a cart comes and catches up on him, driven by a churl, a peasant. And it passes him. And he thinks, if I were in that cart, I'd get faster to Guinevere's rescue. But then he says, this would be a loss of honor to my armor and my role as knight. So he hesitates for three steps about getting into the cart. Because in the cart, people who are being taken to be hung and, you know, punished one way or another, they put in the cart. So it's a dishonor to get into the cart, and then he thinks, no, and he gets in. Then he gets on this adventure. Well, the adventure includes a couple of trials, one of which is my favorite for the whole Middle Ages. It's called the trial of the perilous bed. A number of knights have to experience the perilous bed. You come into a room that's an absolutely naked room, and in the middle of it is a bed on rollers. You are to come in your full armor with sword, spear, shield, and this heavy stuff, and get into that bed. Well, as the knight approaches the bed, it shears away like that. So he comes again, and there it goes the other way. And the knight finally thinks, I got to jump. So with his full gear, he jumps into the bed. And as soon as he hits the bed, it starts bucking like a bronco all over the room, banging against the walls and all that kind of thing. And then it stops. And he's told, it's not finished yet. Keep your armor up. Keep your shield over yourself. And arrows and crossbow bolts come in, bang, 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 so forth. And in one instance, a lion comes in and attacks the knight, and he cuts off the lion's feet, and the two of them are there lying in a pool of blood. Then the ladies of the castle is to be disenchanted by this great event. They come in and they see their knight, their savior, lying dead there, or looking dead. And one of them takes a bit of fur from her whatever she's got on with fur, and puts a bit of the fur in front of his nose, and it moves like that. He's breathing. He's alive. So they nurse him back, and the castle is disenchanted, or whatever it happens to be. Lancelot went through this. My great friend Heinrich Zimmer, talking about these materials one time, asked, what's the meaning of a trial of this kind? This is what you must do if you're going to interpret symbols. You've got to find, what's the sense of a thing like this? And his answer, and I think it's probably correct, is this is the masculine experience of the feminine temperament. It doesn't quite make sense, but there it is. And that's the way it's going this time, that's the way it's going that. And he said, the trial is, hold on, be patient, and don't try to solve it, just endure it, and then all the boons of beautiful womanhood will be yours. Well, that's a good destruction. I was working on a book once on the art of Indian Asia. It's a big two-volume thing and one whole volume of pictures. It's based on some of the work of this same man, Heinrich Zimmer. And I had illustrated the whole darn thing except for about four pictures. Back there in those days, in the 40s, early 40s, there was not the whole pictorial display of Hindu artworks that we have now. The photography since that time has been terrific in India. But then there were only a few pictures of the things I needed, and they were had been taken by the Archaeological Survey of India back in the 10s and 20s and so forth. And I knew that Ananda K. Kumar Swami, who had just recently died, would have had these pictures in his files. So I phoned up to Boston, where his widow was, Louisa, and I said, Louisa, can I come up and look at the doctor's picture file? There are about three pictures I need. And she says, oh, Joe, come on up, it's just fine. So I go up one blistering hot summer day and walk into this apartment with the whole library of Kumar Swami, and she said, the things are there, and I pull out a drawer, and here's this higgledy-piggledy of pictures just thrown in together. So I thought, well, you know, about an hour, 2 hours' work, I can get these things and go home. So I start going through the pictures, and she comes in and says, after about 15 minutes, she said, Joe, it's kind of hot, isn't it? Wouldn't you like to have some lemonade or something like that? I said, okay, so we have lemonade, we sit down, talk, and the day's going on, and so forth, and finally we finish that, and I go back to the pictures. I've hardly gone into them. When she comes in and says, Joe, I think it's about dinner time, isn't it? I said, okay, so we have dinner, and then come out again, and of course the dinner lasted on into the evening, and she said, it'd be perfectly all right, Joe. He said, you can sleep on that couch, nobody minds, perfectly okay. 3 days. The superintendent thought we were having an affair, and I just said to myself, this is the perilous bed. I'm going to stick it out. And now that's the way myths can help you in the actual conduct of life. So I got the pictures, they're in the book, and there's a big history behind it.